seeing as I talked to these families is how much pain there was, and how much the state had crept into every single facet of their lives.
Nathan Thrall and Abed Salama. Nathan's author of the book A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. It just won the Pulitzer Prize. That interview aired on October 5th, 2 days before Hamas's October 7th attack on southern Israel and the start of Israel's assault on Gaza. Visit democracynow.org to see all of our coverage of Israel and Gaza. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Koo, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Ozbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
Listen to Armando Puentes every Sunday from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., playing the best in Tejano mixing with some traditional conjunto, as well as mariachi music and public affairs pertaining to the Latino community. That's Armando Puentes, only on KBOO Portland.
Ready to leave a legacy? KBOO Community Radio invites you to a planned giving workshop with me, Tammy Caress, founder of Caress Law. Join us as we explore charitable and tax-saving techniques through your estate plan, empowering you to secure the future of independent media while leaving a legacy. Save the date for May 30th, 5:30 p.m. at the KBOO station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. Let's shape the future together.
Hi, I'm Tammy.
Hi, I'm Althea.
We're the hosts of The Gap on Fridays at 8 a.m. Sorry. Hi, I'm Tammy.
Nothing about this is funny. There's nothing funny happening at all. Tune into The Gap on KBOO on Fridays at 8 a.m. It's a talk radio.
We talk local news, interview activists and community leaders, and invite callers for a community question.
And current events sometimes.
Intergalactic talk show. Callers from around the universe. Tune into The Gap on KBOO on Fridays at 8 a.m.
For current events,
thoughtful criticism,
and plenty of goofs.
What are you doing?
I'm pulling all the levers. I'm twisting all the knobs. Okay, I'm ready. Action.
Hi, I'm Tammy.
Hi, I'm Althea.
We're the hosts of The Gap on Fridays at 8 a.m.
It's a talk radio show aimed at bridging the gap in our understanding and in our community.
We talk local news, interview activists and community leaders, and invite callers for our community question.
Tune in to The Gap on KBOO on Fridays at 8 a.m.
For current events,
thoughtful criticism,
and plenty of goofs.
See you there.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
This morning, we will not be broadcasting more talk radio with Cecil Prescott. He will be back next week. Please enjoy the next show on the schedule. And thank you for listening to KBOO Portland.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I wanted to check in with a good friend of the show and somebody who has shoulder to the grind, ears to the street, and 2 weeks ago was in Gaza with a delegation of doctors. We wanted to talk to her about that. And then, you know, over the last 36 hours, we've seen, I think, very orchestrated, very targeted, synchronized violence coming from police, from here in California where we're at, to New York where she's at, to remove those who are doing solidarity encampments, to bring attention to the plight of Palestinians. And their only request is being done peacefully, but it's to ask for schools to divest and for there to be a ceasefire. And for that, we've seen police and armor and riot gear, tear gas, and UCLA. We've seen people beaten by mobs. It's just been crazy. And so I wanted to tap into all these different things. And joining us is Nancy Munshaw. Welcome to the show. And we were just saying, it's just madness everywhere.
Please.
And I wanted to just talk to you about the trip to Gaza, because one thing that I'm very concerned about is that the craziness that we're seeing here can quickly become the main focus, and we can forget that there's still carnage, there's still genocide and things going on in Gaza. I don't think people on the ground will think that way, but the way it's being presented, it's almost like what you're seeing in corporate media are the sensationalist acts of the police with no political bent, and definitely not reminding people why they're actually there in the first place to the degree that I think we should. And so hopefully you can connect the dots for us. So I guess my first thing, Gaza, what did you see? What do we need to know? Why were you there?
So first of all, I'm the executive director of Eyewitness Palestine, very much like the organization that I formed, Existence as Resistance, in 2009. We do delegations to Palestine, mostly the West Bank, because we haven't had access to Gaza as often as we would like or at all. I did go to Gaza in 2009 and have been trying to find a way to take people there since, because, you know, the attacks on Gaza are constant, not just since October of last year when some people woke up, but they bomb them, you know, every day pretty much. And then the larger bombardments we've seen over the years. And so when October happened, we had delegations set up to go for the olive harvest in the West Bank and an artist delegation in December of last year. But obviously we postponed them, and we kind of pivoted towards trying to do what we needed to do in the moment for Gaza. And I said to my board, you know, I want to find a way to get to Gaza and take as many medical workers as possible. So in my mind, I was like, I'm going to take 200 or 300 doctors and just go out there. And if anybody knows me well, they know that whatever I put my mind to, I'm going to do some way, shape or form.
Absolutely.
And so fast forward, we kept working on the logistical details, and I was, you know, emailing everybody I knew and every embassy and trying to get a way in. I finally found a way in through an organization called GLIA that's run by a Gazan from Canada, Tariq Lubani. He's a doctor. And they just started sending medical delegations in. And so I led a delegation for them of 10 doctors, myself and Maureen Kaki, who works with me. She's our programming and operations coordinator. And we took 10 doctors into Rafah. We stayed in East Rafah. We actually stayed in a residential building, which is a little different to a lot of these other NGOs. And so we were staying with three other Palestinian families that were refugees from the north. And the area we were staying in, Jnana, it's called, which means garden, was being bombed very heavily. We spent 2 weeks with our 10 doctors based in different sites. We had a doctor based in Deir al-Balah in the middle area, near Nusayrat camp called Shuhada al-Aqsa Hospital. And then we had doctors in clinics and field hospitals and hospitals in Rafah, Najjar Hospital, Dalil Sultan Clinic, Indonesian Field Hospital, and the Emirati Hospital. You know, we saw everything. You know, I say the way I can describe it is Gaza is like the happiest and saddest place on earth. You can literally go from, you know, just wanting to dig a hole in the ground and climbing into it to, you know, just feeling re-energized. And like, you know, the youth, that all you see is children. That's number one. All you see is children. We got to remember Gaza is 2.4 million people, over a million of them being kids. And so it's wild, like it's literally wild that, you know, I mean, that's why you see all these kids that are like blown into pieces or, you know, injured all over the net, because it is all children. It is all children. But as is, right, you know, the Zionist forces or whatever they want to call them, leaders have all stated everybody to them in Gaza is Hamas. And I think people are very, have a very unclear idea of what Hamas is. Hamas is a government in Gaza. And so when you talk about the Ministry of Health, or you talk about the police, or you talk about security, or even the people that clean the streets, the garbage collectors, they would assume they're Hamas because they work for the government. You can't get away from that. These are jobs and people need jobs. And since they're under, since 2006, people take whatever jobs they can get. And so this is why we see all these healthcare workers being murdered in the hospitals that they work in, that they refuse to leave their patients in. You know, they're all, everybody is a target. We didn't see any police, because the only, we did see police cars that were bombed out in the street, because like I said, they're all targets. And so they pretty much all been targeted. So there's no kind of security or police on the streets, which on one hand is crazy because it's completely lawless. But on the other hand, it also shows us that we don't need them. Palestinian community, you know, we don't have people running around, you know, opening fire in schools and things like that, like they do here in movie theaters and just random events.
Right.
You know, if there's a thief that's caught in the street, the community is going to whip his ass until until he doesn't steal anymore. You know, we have, we're very community based. And so it also showed us that people are able to function on a daily. We saw a lot of people getting into arguments and just, you know, the frustration, like they're all homeless, you know, for some people for 5 months, 6 months now, living in a tent on the sidewalk with five, six kids. And so people are releasing their frustration on each other, but you see the elders step in and it's squashed within, you know, a couple minutes.
How are people able to get food? That seemed to be the big control, the main concern.
Right. So Israel's been counting Gazans' calories since they closed Gaza off in 2006. There's been, you know, they literally let in enough food just so that people survive. It's never been like luxuries of, you know, things that, that like chocolate and things like that. But one is the biggest, the trucks that we saw on the Egyptian side, I have a video that's 3.5 minutes long. So, you know, when you're driving, how many miles you can do in 3.5 minutes, right?
Right.
3.5 minutes of thousands and thousands of trucks that are just parked up with aid. Some that have just been sitting there for months, we're told. Thousands, I can't tell you how many, like, I'll have to send you the video. I'm going to WhatsApp you the video. It's wild to see just, that's where people's aid is. Like, it's just sitting there. Israel will let in, like, what, 20 trucks a day if they do. On a regular day without them being bombed, Israel, Gaza was getting, you know, 200 trucks a day. And so now with everything that's happening and the increase for the need of medical supplies and food, they're not even getting, you know, 10% of what it is that they need. So the food that's coming in, there are aid trucks that come in. But what we saw is in every area of tents, there's like one tent that is, that registers where they're from. You know, that has a list of all the names, and they put sheets up every morning with people's name on it of who was going to get a box of aid that day, and they had to rotate. So, you know, if they got 100 boxes in, they would choose 100 people off the list that, you know, hadn't received the aid in a couple of weeks. So people would get boxes, and inside the box, I mean, you know, we're talking about going on 7 months now, inside the box is like cans of tuna. We've seen videos emerge from Gaza with boxes like full of maggots. I mean, because the aid's just been sitting there. And so things are coming in that are completely destroyed. And then it's the same stuff, corned beef and tuna. And who wants to live off canned tuna and corned beef for 7 months? So the good thing is that when we got there, we saw the lack of food, or if there was, like, a carton of eggs was about $100, or close to that for 18 eggs. And by the time we left, because of the weather now, there's more people being able to produce some vegetables and things like that. So they started coming in. So we were literally, we saw, like, every day we would drive through Rafah to the hospitals and you would see, like, all the stores empty. And then as we were leaving the last few days before we left, you would see the fruit start coming. So we saw the potatoes and tomatoes first, and then we saw the cucumber, you know, so things are starting to grow. But obviously nothing is, you just don't know what happens one minute to the next, because they're bombing Rafah like crazy now as well. And so you don't know. But, you know, essentially, is there enough food? Not at all. Can everybody afford to buy the food? Not at all. If you think about the area we were in, which was supposed to be the safe area, which, like I said, was bombed every night and day, it's a city of 230,000 people usually. And now they have 1.7 million people there. And so
it's kind of like everybody's cornered into Rafah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
But that's exactly what it is. Completely cornered. But then all you see is tents. There's not a sidewalk available, just people makeshift tents out of plastic bags. They're not allowing tents in. So anything that is able to get in, so even the medical supplies, we brought thousands of dollars worth of medical supplies into these hospitals, including things like insulin, which Israel won't let in, oxygen tanks. We didn't bring oxygen tanks, but Israel doesn't allow certain things like oxygen tanks. Anything that needs to be refrigerated, they pretty much don't let in. And so we took in medical supplies, and there was 12 of us on this trip, and we had 90 suitcases. We brought in, like, you can walk in with everything. You can walk in with, I don't mean everything like that, but, like, you can bring in so much. But then they know that you're limited as a human, like, how much you can carry. You're limited to how much you can drag across the border. So that was a wild thing. It's like, wow, we can bring these medications that are life-saving, you know, to people, but they won't let them in on the trucks. You know, people aren't thinking about the everyday issues that people have. We're thinking about, like, right now, like, response to, like, injuries of bombings, right, and shrapnel. But we're not thinking about people with diabetes. There's only, you know, in fact, kidney disease, kidney failure. There's only 7 functioning dialysis machines left in Gaza. Now, you have thousands of Palestinians in Gaza with kidney failure. And so what they do is rotate these people on these machines, and the machines, if they're able to salvage, go from one hospital to the next, depending on which one is still functioning. And they literally get now a regular, you know, I have friends who have kidney failure. They have dialysis 4 or 5 times a week for 4 hours a day. In Gaza, they get a couple hours for 1 day a week. And that's how they're rotating the machines. So people aren't thinking about people that have these everyday issues, high blood pressure. There's nothing's coming in. Everything that's coming in is for, you know, the injuries on the spot, you know, even anesthetic isn't getting in like that. So, you know, it's wild. It's wild.
Nancy, the pictures that we saw show just complete devastation. What did you see? I mean, are those pictures shallow in what they're depicting? Are they over exaggerated? What did you see when you were there in terms of infrastructure and all that?
It's wild because, you know, I see Zionists like trying to argue videos and pictures, and it's like it's a real video. It's a real picture.
Right.
The best way to answer that is that what we are seeing on social media, if we think about how many people are left that haven't been murdered, that have been reporting from the ground there, we're thinking of like a few thousand, right, that are reporting from the ground, and maybe just a handful of what we each follow. But then let's think that there's 2.4 million people there that are all pretty much displaced at this point, except for, you know, a few in Rafah. So what we're seeing on social media is maybe about 2% of what's happening on the ground, as far as
wow.
locals as far as like the destruction. I mean, people I spoke to that are from the north, you know, people, some people like go back when they're able to sneak up, or when they were able to sneak up and go back to the north to try and salvage whatever they could from their houses, if there was anything they were able to get. They were like, they couldn't even find their homes because they didn't recognize the streets, because they've everything is gone.
Yeah, and people just can't leave, right? People, you know, they make it seem like people can't come and go as they please. I know it's elementary to you, but for somebody listening who doesn't really know, what is the story with that?
It's funny, you know, it's I'm gonna answer that. It's like this, it's like I had posted pictures when I was in Nusayrat, and you know, the Zionists, like, they just can't take the fact that there's a genocide, right? And they don't really have any argument left, because they're, you know, they just can't hide their crap anymore. You know what I'm saying? People had enough of that. But like, they'll be like, oh, those kids don't look malnutritioned. Like, if they don't see bones hanging out of their neck and like them on the verge of death, they're not malnutritioned. I don't think they understand what malnutrition means. There are plenty of kids that are on the verge of death because they're not eating enough. They want to see it, right? When people talk about people being able to leave Gaza, that's another thing. It's like with all these GoFundMes of people asking to help, right, to get their families out. Some families do have the privilege of being able to leave, as long as they go through a security check and nobody in their family is affiliated with the government, which is not many, right? Because somehow, you know, if your uncle's brother's wife, you know, works in a hospital and is a nurse that takes care of babies, you're affiliated. So the people that can leave, yes, through a process which goes through Israel, which goes through Egypt, and also costs thousands of dollars to be able to leave. So that's why we're seeing these GoFundMes. So it's not, and the only reason, now let's remember how many times, if you just Google Rafah border closed, let's remember how long this border has been closed for. This has been the easiest time for people to pay money to the Egyptians, right, which collaborate with the Israelis and then allow them to leave. But why is that? Because Israel wants them to leave. They don't want a single Palestinian left on our land. That's the aim of all of this, is to get rid of them. And so they're basically like, oh, if they pay, then yeah, they can come out. And I wouldn't be surprised if Israel was getting a cut. Currently, it's $5,000 a person to get out of Gaza. And it was, I mean, it had gone up to 20,000 at one point. Now it's 5,000. I guess business wasn't booming like they expected. Right. So they brought the price back down. But this is what the aim of all of this, and Israel said it, you know, Israel tells you everything they're feeling. They're very open with their racism and their fascism. And they said they were going to make Gaza a parking lot. Well, that's what the north looks like, if people want to know. The north looks like a parking lot with a bunch of rubble on it, with, let's say, you know, tens of thousands of bodies under that rubble too, that have yet to be dug out.
You know, one of the things that was disturbing was seeing those hospitals being bombed. And, you know, you did talk about bringing the doctors there. How many of the doctors are still left? You know, are there any medical facilities at all? The excuse that was being made was that, well, the medical facilities is where the enemy combatants are hiding, so therefore we must bomb them. And it seems like that's what was happening all the time. And then when it got caught, then they actually blamed Palestinians and said they did it, you know, for attention, which makes no sense. But what did you see in terms of that, healthcare workers and, you know, and what's their plight?
So yeah, the medical facilities, we saw the Indonesian in the north get completely destroyed and out of what wasn't functioning. We saw a baby's hospital where they left babies on incubators with no electricity. And, you know, when they did get back into that building, they just found the decaying babies, premature babies, just all dead. Nasser Hospital, that was, the children's hospital. The doctors, as we know, you know, they don't leave their patients. They refuse to leave the hospitals. Al-Shifa Hospital, the occupation, Israel, went in the first time and said, oh, Hamas have a base here. And they went in and murdered people and stormed the entire hospital and bombed around it and said that, you know, they were getting rid of Hamas, and then they left. So did they not do the job the first time? Because remember, they went back a couple weeks ago.
Right.
While we were there, actually, while we were there about 3-4 weeks ago, they went back and they completely destroyed the biggest hospital in Gaza, the one that had most of the life-saving machines. They now, the mass graves that are being found, I don't know if you're hearing, Kamal al-Adwan in the hospital in Khan Yunis, there are mass graves. We're talking about patients with catheters still in their arms, handcuffed behind their back, face down in graves, you know, tens of people in the same grave. This is what these Zionists, the most moral army in the world, did, you know, to the Palestinians. Doctors still in their scrubs were buried. They're saying some people were buried alive too, from the findings. They're finding people that were buried with their organs gone. You know, Israel was, this is a long time story too. This isn't just since October, but Israel's known for selling Palestinian organs on the black market. And so they found, they had taken bodies, as they do. They kidnap many Palestinians all the time, all the time. And we want to talk about kidnapping people. Israel's professional and has been kidnapping people since 1948. They kidnapped people from the north and then sent their bodies back in these blue bags. And when they were examined by doctors, many of their organs were missing.
Wow.
All of this will come out at some point, and then people will feel disgusted at themselves for not having done anything or not done a tiny bit of research to see that, you know, these stories that are coming from there are the people that are living it, telling you their stories, and people are choosing to be silent and ignore it, which means they're complicit in this genocide. And it will be too late for them to do anything, so they'll have to live with that. But the doctors are holding their ground. They, you know, I literally, we did a Zoom yesterday, and if people want to watch it, it's on our website, eyewitnesspalestine.org. And it was actually the healthcare workers from Palestine, from Gaza, that we met with in these different hospitals. They came on the Zoom yesterday and talked about the collapse of the healthcare system. And some of the questions that I posed to them were like, how do you keep going knowing that there's an imminent ground invasion, and having seen your fellow doctors and nurses slaughtered in, you know, the town over 20 minutes away in Khan Yunis or in the north? And, you know, they say we have a duty here, and, you know, and to remember that they're doing this and they have no pay. There's no salaries coming in. There's no government, right, functioning government. So there's no salaries for these doctors, and they're working for free. Some of them 48 hours, like 48 hour shifts. Many of them, like he was, Dr. Salama from the Emirati hospital was saying yesterday, you know, he has people working, like there was a girl that lost her entire family. She came back to work 3 days later, and he says that they work and they're just crying as they work, but they work and they just keep going. You know what I'm saying? They push themselves to keep going, because what else are they going to do? Sit at home and cry and wait to be bombed? I mean, you know, so they're, you know, I mean, we expect them to be these, you know, indestructible, like, superheroes, which they are to some extent. Superheroes, they are superheroes, but they're human. And so I can't imagine the psychological impact that this is going to have long term on everybody in Gaza.
How have you been dealing with this, being an eyewitness? How have you been able to keep your, you know, your mentals together?
You know, the same as before I went. I have my moments, you know, like even today I broke down for a while. It's a privilege. Like, everything we do is a privilege, you know what I'm saying? Because people think that they are not open to having this happen to them, and it can happen at any moment anywhere in the world, right? You know, I just feel like, for me to say I'm Palestinian and just carry that like it's like, you know, it's a right or something, it's not. And if I want to say I'm Palestinian, then I am the privileged one that was able to, you know, be brought up and live in another country, which gives me a voice, which gives me more rights to be able to do and say more for my people. And so if I want to say I'm Palestinian, then I have to do something, because the Palestinians that are holding down the land, the Palestinians in Gaza especially, and the West Bank, I mean, you need a whole nother show just to talk about what they're doing in the West Bank, because they're being slaughtered there too by these American settlers that are running around with automatic weapons opening fire on Palestinians every single day, and not just since October. But I think that the fact that they have to endure this suffering over and over and over and over, you know, in the name of our land, then the least that we can do is to speak out and not be so privileged that we're going to cry. Like, where is everybody's backbone? Like, I understand, you know, I'm constantly told self-care, self-care, you know, blah, blah. I understand all that. But like, when people tell me that I'm going to burn out, like, I don't understand. Like, to me, it just sounds so privileged. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, if I get a little bit tired and I pass out early one night because I haven't slept in 3 nights, so what? At least I'm sleeping, and at least I have a roof over my head, and at least my baby is still alive. So, yeah. You know, that's what keeps me going, is my people keep me going. You know, like, I can't, you know, they're so inspiring. At the same time, I will say this. When I was there, you know, I went, we took our own canned food, we took our own water, we took our own everything, because we didn't want to take anything from what aid was getting in. We didn't want to take any water from that, you know, anything like that. But I told you we were staying in a residential building with Palestinian families that were refugees from the north. And there was not one day that in the 2 weeks that we were there that these families didn't cook for everybody in that building. And I had 12 people in our apartment, 12 people.
Wow.
And they brought food up every single day. We have something in Arabic, it's called karama, like the hospitality, the kindness, right? And Palestinians are known for their hospitality before these attacks, after, you know what I'm saying? Like, even during a genocide, this was unmatched. The love that the Palestinians showed us was unmatched. Like, I literally would cry. We cried more about how giving and loving our people were, and the Palestinians were towards us during a genocide, than we did at the stuff that we saw. Like, we would cry, like, you know, look, there was a doctor with me, and they haven't had chocolate, like real chocolate, you know, they love Galaxy chocolate, things like that, right? And there was a doctor that came with me, his name's Dr. Kutayba. He's from, he's Jordanian, living in Qatar. And he was working in one of the hospitals, and there was a doctor that somebody had just came in from another NGO, and they brought this doctor a piece of chocolate. And this doctor shared this chocolate. He broke it in half and gave half to our doctor, Kutayba. And that day, Dr. Kutayba came back to the apartment, and he was just beside himself. He was in tears. He's like, who am I that this guy hasn't had his favorite chocolate in 6 months? Wow. And he shared it with me. He's like, why? Like, you know, like, but it's more, it's deeper than a piece of chocolate. You know what I'm saying? It's deeper than that. It's just how much love that Palestinians are still showing, right? That hasn't, like I said, it's unmatched, it's untouched. Like, that part of us that's in our culture to give, at the end of the day, this is what they kept saying. Like, when I kept saying, it's too much, you've got to stop cooking for us. You've got to stop, like, we're here to help. You know what I'm saying? We don't need anything. Their thing is like, you are our guests, you are in our hood, you are in our space, and you're right. Our, and we wish we could give you more. That's all they would say. We wish we could give you more. It's like, you know what I mean? That, wow, would drive me crazy. It would drive me crazy. But that's how Palestinians are. If they have a grain of rice, they're giving you half of it. And you know, we felt that love, and that was the beauty of it too.
I'm glad you were able to share that, and hopefully people that are listening or move to action, you know, that they're just not listening to Nancy Mazur, you know, talking, and, you know, we're living vicariously, but to get up and be like, let me get on the phone with some elected official and push them, and let me, you know, let me use, you know, whatever resources I have to stop, you know, the type of carnage that is unfolding. You know, as we close out, any marching orders you want to give our listeners, anything that you think we should be paying attention to at this point in time?
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the students on campus, you know, even if the focus is on them, their focus is Palestine, and so we should support them. We should support them, and you know, I probably should watch what I say, but it's unacceptable that the pigs think it's okay to beat students who are standing up against a genocide. They are not okay with their institutions supporting Israel and its genocidal actions. They are not okay with it, and they have every right to demonstrate that. They are not violent. They are protesting. They are protesting non-violently, although, you know, in international law, Palestinians that they call, you know, terrorists because they resist have every right under international law to resist with arms. The student protesters are exercising their right to protest and demonstrate, and they're being met with riot gear, tasers. They're being beaten, pepper sprayed. Yesterday in UCLA, you saw the Zionists now spilling into California, with their violence is spilling into California, where they went in and beat people in the encampment, you know, over the head with sticks and split a few people's heads open while the cops stood there and watched. This is exactly what the Israeli army does. It stands by and watches as settlers open fire on Palestinians, and it protects those settlers. And that's what they're doing here. And I think we are getting a very, very clear-cut image now of what we've been talking about for a long time, which, you know, I'm sure you've heard about, that these cops here are being trained by the Israeli occupation forces. The NYPD has an office in Israel. Why? Why did TSA officers get trained by Israelis? They just want to know how to be as brutal as possible. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that people should stand with the students, support the students. And I don't think Israelis should feel, I'm going to say this. Are there Israelis that are pro-peace? Maybe a few, maybe a few. They'll let you know who they are. But if we go by the Israeli Democracy Institute's numbers of their surveys that they've been doing for years, it shows you that approximately 80 to 87% of Israelis are pro-genocide. They are pro-wiping out the Palestinian people. And so I don't think that Israelis should feel comfortable anywhere walking around trying to make a case of why murdering 40,000 Palestinians is okay at all. And so I think it's time to start making the comfortable uncomfortable. That's what I think.
Nancy, we appreciate you taking time out. How can they follow your organization?
Thank you. Sorry, getting a little bit emotional. Eyewitness Palestine. We're on Instagram. Existence is resistance. We're on Instagram. We have a website, eyewitnesspalestine.org. People can watch our past events there. We do a lot of Zooms with folks on the ground. We support organizations that are working with women and children and others on the ground, farmers. So please follow www.eyewitnesspalestine.org. And if people are interested in going to Palestine and witnessing firsthand for themselves, so that, you know, it can be a clear picture of what's happening, which is always the best method, right, is to go and see for yourself. Nobody can debate you on that. Nobody can argue you down that you just, you know, witnessed some crazy apartheid militarized state. You know, hit us up. We have forms on there people can fill out if they're interested and get more info. I appreciate you, brother. Thank you for giving me the space.
Thank you. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Said I need dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. And if I share with you,
bienvenidos y bienvenidas. Welcome to PNA, Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. This is your co-host Muteado Silencio, con voces de migrantes en resistencia, in studio today with Pabri Scala, Popoe, mi carnala Tiny.
From Palestine to Turtle Island, shouts out to all the warriors who are taking back these stolen land campuses to resist the lies of genocide by this politrickster government of Americland.
On today's broadcast, A Poor People's Radio, we will speak with comrades from one of the only social justice-oriented public schools in the whole Bay Area, the June Jordan High School, which is now facing closure, all that and much more, on Poor People's Radio.
I break promises of a better life to come. Where the poor can get some more and the weak will get stronger. I've heard talk of legislation, but they haven't solved the poor man's situation.
From Palestine to Turtle Island, our bodies are under attack. When we on the street and put up a tent, our tents are taken. Because when we sleep outside, our bodies and belongings are viewed as trash. We can't have a tent when we don't have money for the rent. But you know what else is under attack? Our babies' education, that's what. Especially if we try to teach them the valid and real histories and histories that built our lives and our ancestors, our communities and our tierras who take care of Mother Earth. These are the things our babies need to hear, to learn, to lift up, and to love up. But now, a lot of the beautiful schools in many of our communities, it's none other than Jude Jordan High School, facing closure. We are blessed to have on the line a warrior, son of one of my heroes, one of our ancestor familia, Bill Soro, his badass son, Julio Soro. Welcome to Poor People's Radio.
Thank you. How's everybody doing?
We good, we good. So let's talk about what fake excuse they're pulling on one of the only social justice high schools in the Yay.
You know, it's an extension to everything that our folks have been talking about of colonialism and gentrification in the present form. That's at the root of it. And so basically, you know, we have under enrollment in the city, like many places. The idea, you know, is under enrollment, so we lost numbers. But a little history on June Jordan. Obviously, the name itself of the poet June Jordan from UC Berkeley, Poetry for the People in San Quentin, you know, being named after her, you know, there's going to be a little something different than Washington High or Lowell High School or Galileo or Fremont or something like that. And so it came about in the late 90s. I remember City College, they came up there when I was at City College. They said, hey, we want to start a school. And there's a long story behind it, but it's the parents and the students. And, you know, when Frisco had long, strong organizers, let's create our own school. We don't want a school like Lowell High School. So we decided to create something different on the other side of town. And it was a beautiful creation. 400 parents came out and teachers and all these people who had a different vision. And I think it was still kind of off the coattails of the work we were doing, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. So it's the only school maybe in the Bay Area or for a good long period, particularly that time, that came out of a community struggle. And it was a beautiful thing. And we always had a lot of political support, and we did powerful, wonderful things there just across the line. We had our own curriculum. We had portfolios. You know, we dealt with the kids, all the communities, Excelsior, Mission, Sunnydale, the schools kids didn't want to deal with. And it was a very loved home. And long story short, over time, just many things from COVID to turnover to gentrification. And then we had a shooting. We kind of went through a dark period where we lost a lot of that spiritual energy that we had. We're trying to regain it. It's a hard spot. So now where we're at now is, you know, there's a declining population in San Francisco, but like many cities. What do they do? Put on the chopping block is the smaller schools who says that we know what's more important, that our young people feel cared about as a whole human being than just a number for a test score. So they started putting these schools up like our school, Academy, O'Connell, all on the east side of town, mostly kids of color, black and brown kids, kids with IEPs, working class kids, immigrant kids. And so that's where they started trying to chop down on that. They started organizing and fighting back. And we had 100 people turn out to the rally, students from 10, 15 years ago. People came out. But there's a bigger underlying thing here, and it goes back to settler colonialism, just basic capitalism. Is when we started talking to our comrades across the bay in Oakland, we came to learn that every single school that was closed down, black and brown, was then replaced by charter schools. And then, you know, you got to go even deeper, because in San Francisco, you have a very strong Chinese population. which could be, okay, people of color, immigrant, all these things. But then there's this whole thing of low high school, good scores. Chinese kids don't want to go to the school. So most of the kids who live in the district, they go cross town because of this deeper anti-black, brown kind of stigma of that it's a bad school.
Mo, did you have a question you wanted to ask?
What are some solutions that parents and teachers are coming up with?
I think one thing, talking with some of the folks in Oakland already, that there's these state, they call them guardrails. And anytime you're trying to close down a school, is it affecting black and brown kids? Is it affecting poor kids? Is it affecting kids with IEPs? Is it affecting immigrant students? And of course it is. So there's these state, what they call guardrails, that is potential like lawsuit areas. That's never been our realm of like suing the system. We don't want the system, right? But I think that has been strategically some of the teachers who are kind of in that realm, that there's actually, it's illegal to close these schools down because it goes against these, again, they call them guardrails. And you know, the last thing, Tiny, now, you know, back in the day, school board elections and all that, we used to be able to get our folks on there. Everything's being contested. The school board members, they're running for, whether it's Arizona or Oakland or San Francisco, everything is up for a battle now. There ain't no free pass for us to just have our space. So, you know, the battle is on, and it's been on, but I think stakes getting higher and everybody's choosing a side.
Well, you got to tell us who we got to get behind on that school board mess in Frisco, okay? To help us with that voter's guide, Blood.
Thank you for news.
We'll talk soon. Before we houseless, we evicted. The lie of eviction, the lie of rent, the ways that it impacts our families, our elders, our babies, as Poor Magazine has marched for and talked about for years and fought for, eviction is elder and child abuse. In that vein, we have a powerful warrior fighting for housing justice for Juanita in occupied Tavangar, aka LA, who's going to talk about this fight and why we all need to show up and show out for this family, this familia. Iris, welcome to Poor People's Radio.
Hello. I want to say thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to speak. My name is Iris. I am a volunteer with the Housing for Juanita campaign. Our practice is really rooted in the history of Filipinos being the largest group of exported workers in the world. The Philippine government has really systematically and forcibly displaced Filipinos from their homeland to seek better wages in these foreign countries, to send money back home and help their families who are often living in poverty. But the truth is that the reason why we are the largest group of exported workers is because our labor is sold for very cheap. Historically, Filipinos have been sought out for labor because we are hard workers and it comes at a very low price to employers. So really, it exacerbates the cycle of Filipinos being displaced from their homeland and then further displaced in these foreign countries due to abusive workplaces. And when we are in these stages of economic depletion, like the pandemic, it further displaces these migrant workers. So the group of unhoused Filipinos that we're working with were encamped on Juanita Street in historic Filipino town, which is where we get our namesake. Juanita is the name that we're using for their community because while they were encamped on Juanita Street, they had really formed a family of their own, lifting each other up and helping each other. When we first started this campaign, we were visiting them weekly at this encampment, and we were actually there the day that their encampment was swept. And we were able to see really how violently the government displaces unhoused people further. They're already in an encampment and then the police pulls up with bulldozers and they're being threatened with further displacement. They're told that their only choice is to leave and their belongings will be destroyed or they can sign on to Mayor Karen Bass's Inside Safe program and are allowed to bring two bags of their belongings. So a lot of the people that we're working with were really given no choice, because either they're displaced to another location and are separated from the community that they've been able to build, or they can sign on to this program. It has been 6 months now that they've been in this program, and it has really revealed how the program has lied and has continued to neglect them. A lot of this group were a great example of these exported workers from the Philippines, where they were migrant workers who came here in the 80s and have lived and worked in LA most of their lives and have now lost their homes and livelihood due to the government's really lackluster response to COVID that has skyrocketed our unhoused population in LA. So our aim is to really uplift these people's voices who are continuing to face neglect even being in this Inside Safe program. At the motel that they live in, they face harassment, they face disgusting living environments where during the flooding, the rooms had mold and their trashes are always overflowing. There are lots of rats and maggots. And as much as this group is really grateful to be off the street, the truth is that the treatment that they face is really carceral. The program does not allow them to have visitors. They aren't allowed to have contact with the other residents in their room.
But these are elders, and the motel owners, who are also oftentimes poverty scholars, taking a dime exactly. from the parlor tricksters. Let's be real. A lot of our poor folks practice exploitation as well. And they've got them in basically uninhabitable living spaces. Have you charged the city with habitability violations?
We have really been trying to uplift the residents' voices and highlight really the failures of this program that is touted by Mayor Karen Bass as a savior program. It gets all of this money, millions of dollars are funneled into it, and we know that it's going to the same people in power.
Can you tell listeners what's the best way for them to support you all?
The best way to get connected with us and follow our campaign is through our Instagram and Facebook. Our Instagram handle is Housing for Juanita.
Thank you so much, Iris. Housing for, the number four, Housing for Juanita on Instascam and Housing for Juanita on Facecrack, AA Facebook.
Thank you.
All right.
Have a good day.
You too. Talk to you soon. Okay, bye-bye. With Sudanese singer Iman El Sharif. Right now, a lot of what we're putting our hearts and our energy and our minds on is our relatives in Palestine. And so it's really important, especially for us revolutionaries, to lift up and love up the other stories, the other her stories, the other forms of violent genocide happening across Mama Earth, from West Papua to Kashmir, from the Congo to Haiti, to Palestine, and to Sudan. To do some of that, we are blessed to bring a powerful warrior, a family member, a scholar, and a poverty scholar to the air. Welcome back to your family, Jeremy Miller.
My pleasure. Appreciate the opportunity.
What's going on in Sudan? What has been going on? What's led up to this moment that relatives are dealing with? Famine and all of these different things.
You had the revolution between 2018 and 2019. What was quite amazing about this revolution is it was largely powered by civil society. And there was this brief moment of hope, much like what happened up north in 2011 in Egypt with the Tahrir revolution, there was this brief moment of hope that the power could possibly be retained by the people. Unfortunately, the military came in and took power. The military has taken over at this point, and a year ago, two different armed factions, the Sudanese Armed Forces, the formal military, and the so-called Rapid Support Forces, which was a basically death squad that was created in the early 2000s, around 2003, to commit genocide in the west of the country against the people of Darfur, the Darfur region. There was an attempt, with all this new government forming, there was an attempt to incorporate the redubbed Rapid Support Forces, a.k.a. Janjaweed, into the formal Sudanese military chain of command so that there weren't competing, heavily armed strategic factions. And, of course, this would have meant a surrender of power by the head of the Rapid Support Forces, a man by the name of Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemedti. And so he rejected this. The open warring conflict erupted on April 15th of last year. So we just crossed the 1 year mark. Both the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, aka Janjaweed, are murdering and oppressing the people. You're talking about millions of people displaced, hundreds of thousands killed. It's a really horrific conflict. And frankly, the world has completely dropped the ball on even paying attention to it. The language that I would use there is I would say the normalization of African death. Maybe 9 million, 8-9 million people have had to flee the fighting. Over 1 million have left the country. Not to say that love and support should be withdrawn in any way from anywhere else, but you're talking astounding numbers. I mean, over half the country facing famine, 25 million, and no one's saying anything. And this is not something that happened yesterday. Media coverage. There's been a, no pun intended, complete media blackout, more or less. There's always beautiful energy trying to mobilize resources to reach the people in need in Palestine and elsewhere. That needs to happen on the double with Sudan as well. And it's difficult because they are being intercepted by both the Sudanese armed forces at different points and the Rapid Support Forces. So it's not easy. I'm not trying to paint like some easy silver bullet or something like that. But nonetheless, people are starving. So that's necessary. This is the tragic calculus of those in power. They are perfectly content to let millions die so long as it doesn't change their election prospects.
There you have it, relatives. Thank you, Jeremy. We love you. Appreciate you. Talk to you soon.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Chris Juwan Cam. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else is just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock. Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right. Feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on.
Check out.
Why every obvious pick they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost or the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat to the belly from the steel grave beef. Say, please, maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say, peace to the lovers I need.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
We'll be right back.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hi, this is Melissa Lesniak, the creator and host of That Vegan Show. On That Vegan Show, you will hear in-depth guest interviews on vegan-related topics, such as companion animals, environmentalism, social issues, and food and nutrition. We also learn about specific animals such as possums and rabbits, including their needs and ways to help them. Be sure to tune in to That Vegan Show on the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. right here on KBOO Portland.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots from energy to extreme weather, public health, and more. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz. Join me for Climate Connections during the